welcome to the final Canucks Talk of the 2023-2024 National Hockey League season. I'm Brendan Batchelor, the play-by-play voice of the Vancouver Canucks.
And I'm Thomas Drantz. Yes.
Filling in for Jamie Dodd, and I'm joined by Canucks Insider, covers the team for The Athletic. Yes, his name is Thomas Drantz.
The Insider is a Russell Crowe movie, man.
Yes, that is true. It is a big day on Canucks Talk today.
Al Pacino was also in it.
He was.
It was directed by Michael Mann. Do you want to know more facts about the film The Insider?
Sure, why not?
No, that's all I got.
Okay. It's a big day on Canucks Talk. We'll get into that in a moment.
It was nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, okay. There you go. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet. What are you waiting for? It is Friday. It is the last Canucks Talk, as I mentioned. And so today is Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day.
What?
Because it is Thomas Drantz's final show for the summer. So we've got lots of time on the show. We've only got one guest. Kevin Woodley is going to join us just after 1 o'clock.
That's awesome.
So we're going to take texts and input and questions from you guys because it's your last chance on the airwaves to bathe in the wisdom of one Thomas Drantz.
Bathe in the wisdom.
So here are the rules for today. Today is Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day. You can ask us any Canuck related question and we will get to as many of them as we can throughout the show. But in order for us to have a chance to answer your question, you have to say something nice about Thomas Drantz first.
What is this?
It's Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day.
What if someone sends something nice in about you?
No, it's not Brendan Batchelor. My final show for the summer is next Friday. So if people want to do that next Friday, they can.
Okay.
But today is about you, buddy. For a guy that takes a lot of flack, it is polarizing in this market at times. We need a love-in today for Thomas Drantz, so that's what we're doing.
Well, that's very kind. You know, the summer months get a little long and a little lonely without this microphone here in front of me and Jamie Dodd on my right side and our excellent listeners mostly tweeting insults about how I don't know what I'm talking about. So, you know, I'll miss it. Obviously, a blast all season to do this with you. And thanks to everybody who listened. And thanks to everybody who texts in and says, you know, mean stuff despite the instructions from our good friend Brendan Batchelor. You guys are the real heroes.
So the way you can get a hold of us is on the 650-650
like
Dunbar
a little bit here,
Lumber Batchelor text line. That was the goal. So
I'm so bad at taking compliments. It remains. So
this is going to be the best 2 hours ever then. I'm really... the Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, and much like Thomas Drantz, more awesome. Details at DunbarLumber.com. And the texts are flooding in already.
Oh,
here's John in White Rock. I love Thomas's cackle laugh. It always makes me feel so confident about my own laugh. Thank you, Thomas.
Yeah, you're welcome. Happy happy to be the grenade in the group of laugh friends.
Here's Corey the Carpenter. Every time Thomas Drantz laughs, an angel gets their wings. What do you really think about your erotica song intro on the morning show?
Oh, I love it. I really, really love it. Occasionally, I'll be walking in public and someone will yell Thomas Drantz erotica at me. And that's always funny because it depends like what company I'm with. Like I was with my dad and he was like, what did that person just say to you? And I like had to explain the bit. My wife's used to it now. So no, I'm a big fan. It's look, first of all, A-Dog's intros.
They're phenomenal.
They're unbelievable.
Yeah. Every single one.
Every single one, a banger. Do you have a favorite?
I'm partial to my own, but
yeah,
I'm biased. Yours is probably the funniest, I would say.
I agree with you, but as a song, like as a jingle, I think the Moj, and then Rick Dollywall with like that like, doot, 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 in the back is really, really good. So I'm a huge fan of the A-Dog tracks, and obviously I love hearing Shorthouse do anything. So yeah, and no, really good. And then were you there when there were people who thought it was PDO?
Oh, that's
good. They didn't think it was
PDO.
They thought it was like reflective of my constant defense and appreciation of Elias Pettersson's game.
There was a while when Phil DiGiuseppe arrived that I didn't get that PDG was PDG, and I thought it was PTG, like PD is a G, and we like him. And I was like, what are we doing here? This makes wait, did I like live under a rock and miss a new nickname for Petey? And eventually I figured it out.
It's like I used to think the like Corolla thing was about Connor Garland. And then I was like, no, that makes no sense.
I am honestly having to wade through a bevy of texts in the Dunbar Lumber text line.
I'm like trying not to look like you're like, you know, for a guy who takes a lot of flack in the market, it's like I would far rather deal with that to be total. I'm one of those guys. You know what I mean? Like I would far rather deal with that.
Yeah.
Than anyone being kind. that's the real way to be mean to me.
Okay, so we said again, you've got to pay the toll, you've got to pay Drancer a compliment, and then we'll answer your Canucks based question. So here's an unsigned text.
The troll toll.
Yes, exactly. Thomas is the best at being the worst. Which is followed up by the question, why is Seelovs not a shoe-in for the backup?
Well, I think he's the heavy favorite, but he's unsigned. And you know, I'm curious to see how this one plays out. A lot of the time with these non-arbitration eligible RFAs, the way that it plays out is the team will offer a one-year deal that's like league minimum, but fully guarantees you an NHL level salary, which is, you know, far better than what Seelovs is entitled to on his current qualifying offer, which only entitles him to like, whatever, $100,000 at the American League level. So usually, you know, these are players that a team grinds down. Now, the Canucks have a different sort of philosophy with players, non-star players coming out of their ELCs. The Canucks want to do two-year deals at in and around $1 million, right? We've seen it with Hoglander. We've seen it with Pod Colson. I was asking around last week about sort of where Seelovs was at, given that there's not a lot of business. Like the Canucks don't have a lot of other business to attend to, which sort of shine like there's a world where Hronek, Elias Pettersson, and Seelovs would all be unsigned RFAs. Or if the team had, you know, tendered Aiden McDonough and that one, it's like, hey, and then you sort of hide in the tall grass. But this one, it's like, Seelovs. The team wants to do a two-year deal in line with the Hoglander and Pod Colson deal. Seelovs, I don't know exactly what his side wants, but I can tell you this. They want NHL games. They think he's ready to play NHL games. Goaltenders, like even young goaltenders like Seelovs, like you don't look at this like I'm going to be the backup. You look at this like I'm going to be ready every time I get in to help a team win. You know, and if I'm good enough, that role will keep expanding. Like that's how you think about it. He doesn't have a lot of leverage given the lack of arbitration rights. This is not sort of the contract you win. So I would imagine at some point the team will get more or less what they want. It's just kind of a matter of when, and it's a matter of how much frustration builds on each side over the course of the summer. Because I've seen these get I've worked in situations where these got pretty touch and go over the course of the summer. But they always end up in the team's favor. Team always gets what they want.
Yeah.
Players in RFA with no arb rights, like it's really open shut. When next season begins, you know, even though Seelovs is waiver exempt, I think the team, like, I think it'll take a lot for him to not get meaningful NHL games, which isn't to say that Patera, you know, necessarily gets exposed. I think he'd be claimed. I think he'd be in demand. So we'll sort of see how the club handles it. But the two main things here are this one could drag out a bit. I do get the sense that there's a little bit of frustration. The Canucks want to do a two-year deal. Those are like, take all of that to the bank. That's mm-hmm. all true. Seelovs is waiver exempt. And in a world where he's not the backup, it will be because the club decides to protect their goalie depth as opposed to a reflection of Seelovs' ability. And even if Seelovs does go down, you know, I think the club will look at it like he's still going to play NHL games this season. We're just going to get him 15 in the NHL and 30 in the AHL.
Yeah.
And by the way, I actually think that's best for Seelovs. Probably not what Seelovs wants, but if you give a guy a one-way deal, if you guarantee him a full-time NHL salary, you know, my explanation would just be like, hey, look, if you're a full-time backup, you're playing 25 games, max.
Assuming Demko health.
Always a big assumption. Yes. But assuming the health of any goaltender is always a big assumption. And yet, you know, I think Seelovs has shown enough that they need to be protective of making sure that he gets 50-plus game reps. Because this is a guy who I think showed us, showed the world, showed the Canucks, that, like, you know, he's not just a good goalie. He might have starter upside down the line. And if you're going to have starter upside down the line, I think it's important that you have that like repertoire, have that volume, get those game reps where you're playing constantly all the time. So that's sort of what I hope to see with C-Loves. I think Patera was an interesting fit. But yeah, I do think he's like the front runner to be the backup. And if he's not, it'll just because the club decides to prioritize the sort of overall depth, which they have a unique opportunity to do, given Seelovs' rare status as like a true NHL-ready goaltender who was also waiver exempt. Very rare you get a goalie you feel that comfortable about playing games who you can also sneak through without requiring waivers.
Well, it's rare that a goaltender in Seelovs' position gets the runway he did in the postseason last year, right? Like that's
sure.
pretty unique for an inexperienced goaltender to play as much as he did in big games and show that he can do it, or have the opportunity even to show that he can do it at the NHL level. And we'll have this conversation in terms of Patera and Seelovs and how it might all fit in with Kevin Woodley coming up just after 1 o'clock when he joins us on the show. And on Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day, we will make sure Woodley says something nice about you as well. But this is the benefit of having your farm team in Abbotsford, is it not? Like, you know, once we move on from the fact that we expect him to be signed here at some point, he's a young goaltender who's still developing. You can send him down the highway to play a few games. If Demko is going to be, if you got a long homestand with, you know, minimal back-to-backs or situations where you're not going to get your backup in very often, then why do you have Seelovs here practicing when he could be playing games down the highway? Like this is one of the biggest areas where they can utilize and weaponize the fact that they moved their AHL team into their own backyard.
Well, and especially if they don't use that $3.5 million in available cap space that they currently can rely on, right? You know, what other contributors do you have on this, in this lineup, basically, that are able to go up and down without requiring waivers, right? Like that's a factor here.
Because, are there honestly any?
No.
Yeah.
But there are guys who I think would go unclaimed. Like I think Neil Zaman is a very, very good bet to get through waivers because he's got an $825K salary. So it's not the league minimum deal and it's one way. So, like, fully guaranteed NHL salary. So
you're not saving any money by sending him down.
No, you're not saving him any money by sending him down. And so you really need to see Neil Zaman is like a must-have player. The fact that he's depth that's that expensive should at least ward off some teams. And maybe all of them, right? Maybe there's teams that would take a shot at a 24-year-old, you know, lanky center with good wheels. I mean, that's an
good penalty killing ability.
Yeah, that's an appealing proposition for some, but also, you know, there's not a lot of offense there, probably not a lot of upside there. It's 50-50 at best that he'd get through. You know, he's sort of the only one, though, that has like meaningful protection. I mean, could a player, there's other players that could maybe get through, but not, you know, it's not like there's nothing built in. It's not by design that they'd get through. It's just that they're kind of replacement level depth guys or viewed that way around the league. Unless a Archdeep Baines or Linus Karlsson crashes the party at training camp, the Canucks don't have the waiver exempt guy to ferry up and down between Vancouver and Abbotsford. Except for Archer Seelovs. And that's worth paying attention to because that's the way that you told daily cap space, right? Like in a world where the Canucks are operating outside LTI, what you want to do is finish every day with 20 or every day, certainly when you're at home, with 22 or 21 guys on the roster so that amount of cap space that you have rolls over and gets like slowly added to your pot.
Then use prior to the trade deadline to add meaningful pieces.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and you know, this is something to watch for because you don't toll daily space in LTI. It's the lack of flexibility has bothered the team. And, you know, Seelovs in some ways is like the most obvious candidate to do it. But, you know, the dynamics there are a little tricky because you always have to have two goalies on the roster.
Well, could you not always have Patera on the roster and then
ferry him up and down?
Ferry Seelovs up and down.
Yeah. That's
you right.
Could.
Like that's and have three goaltenders on the roster if you want to get Seelovs up to play an NHL game or two.
Yeah, you still would want, like,
because then the other benefit to that is we talked so much about managing Thatcher Demko's workload. If you're giving Demko a night off, you can give him a full night off. Like he can not even be on the bench.
Yeah.
If you can fit it into your roster. Now, you know,
I'm a big fan of that,
right? Like you can have, you know, Seelovs come up and play. Patera still wears the ball cap and backs up, and Demko doesn't even have to put on his gear and can put his feet up in the press box.
I mean, I think that's or spend the game working out. right? I think that's the way to do it. I think teams should be considering goalie rest in terms of mental load in that respect. I know Kevin Woodley agrees. We can get into this conversation a little more with Kevin when he joins us at 1 p.m. But yeah, no, I look, that all makes sense to me. The dynamics of exactly how the Canucks will manage the bottom end of their roster, especially if they go through the summer without making a Pullman move, are going to provide us a lot more fodder than they should. Like, it's not the sexiest radio topic, and yet it's going to be fascinating to watch as next season proceeds.
Come training camp, it's going to be fascinating because there are some legitimate camp battles now. Like,
right.
Prior to the signings they made, we were talking about, okay, there's going to be room for Pod Colson or Baines or Carlson or any of these guys to be on the roster. That room's not there anymore, really. Like, there's maybe one spot among those guys, and we brought up Neil Zomon. He very well could be the guy to fill that.
Yeah, no, but
in terms of, okay, there will be space on the roster in terms of, like, being in the lineup every night, though.
Right. But I'm just saying, if you're Linus Carlson, if you're Jonathan Lekaramäki, like, it's not like you're coming to camp and you need to beat out like a Matthias Janmark or something. You know what I mean? Like, you're coming to camp and you need to beat out both of Phil DiGiuseppe and Neil Zomon. Yeah, I'm not saying that's simple to do. Like, Phil DiGiuseppe was an awesome fourth liner for the Canucks last season. Neil Zomon does some interesting things pretty well. If he can ever become like a really good faceoff guy or add a little bit of offensive flair, I think he could be an everyday player, right? I think he could be a third line center if he could do both of those. Well, certainly one of them. If he could win draws at a high level, I think he's already a
penalty killing usable player.
Well, he takes
up
so much space. He's so like disruptive.
Yeah.
In terms of how he defends. But yeah, if he was like a 55% faceoff guy, he'd be like a $1.5-2 million player right off the bat, even if the offense never comes. Anyway, point being,
the
point being, though, that you've got to be able to, if you're an NHL player, you got to be able to beat those guys out.
Oh yeah, 100. But that the good thing is that you now have to beat those guys out, right? Like, it's not two of them or three of them that are going to make the roster because they've brought in Sherwood, because they've brought in Heinen. That competition is there. Again, maybe not in terms of being on the roster, but in terms of being in the lineup, in terms of the top 12 forwards. And that's going to be one of the most interesting parts of training camp is those battles right at the bottom of the lineup. And then, as we've sort of talked about this week, and your take on this actually gained a lot of traction yesterday, both positively and negatively, at the top of the lineup in terms of how to best deploy your top six forwards is, to me, like, those are the two most interesting talking points going into training camp for the Canucks as we sit right now here on July 5th.
Yeah, and do they, the Hughes-Hronek thing, I don't think they feel like their blue line's in a state where they can separate Hughes and Hronek, but the way to think about that is not will they do it at training camp, it's can they make the move that lets them, right? Like, the way to think about that is something the organization aspires to, as opposed to something the organization's going to necessarily do at training camp. So especially if they add another defender, that's going to be that's the dark horse to be an interesting question going into training camp. Yeah, no, look, I'm looking forward to it. Do you know where it is yet?
Not officially, no.
Can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be good. It's always an exciting time of year.
It's my favorite time of year.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. I love training camp. Yeah, I don't know why.
Everything's new. Everything's fresh. You've been away from it for a while, so you're excited to get back.
Totally.
Like, it's renewed your enthusiasm for the game and for being around the rink from our perspective, I think. So it's going to be good. It's going to be a lot of fun, and it's going to be a very interesting start to the year as well, especially, I think, if they don't make any more moves, because then what you're alluding to, the potential of operating outside of LTIR, tolling daily space, how they manage those sorts of things becomes a big factor and an interesting one, I think, to follow heading into the season, because it's not something that we have followed with this team in a while. Like, do you know off the top of your head how many years straight they've been operating in LTIR? It feels like a lot. Like, they had Ferland before Pullman.
The entire time I've been here. So Ferland went on LTI in 2019-20 following the Halloween fight against Kyle Clifford. Yeah, in Los Angeles. That was sort of the, and then remember he like almost came off. He went and did a conditioning loan in Utica and couldn't get through the second period. And it was like 2 days later that the Canucks made the Toffoli trade because they realized they had the LTI space. So that was sort of the start of the Canucks being perpetually in LTI. Even before the Pullman deal expired, or sorry, even before the Ferland deal expired, Tucker Pullman was added to the LTI bill. And yeah, it's interesting too. Like, there was a version of the Nate Schmidt trade that included Michael Ferland's contract. And Ferland was even asked to waive and had agreed to do so because he had no trade protection.
Yeah.
So he had to sign off even though he was just an LTI guy, but obviously has a close relationship with Kelly McCrimmon dating back to their days with the Brandon Wheat King. So he was willing to sign, but there were iterations of the Schmidt trade in which the Canucks paid a better than third round pick asset for Nate Schmidt.
Yeah, to clarify, when they acquired Nate Schmidt, not when they moved him out. Yeah.
And in exchange would send Vegas the LTI'd contract. Organization declined to do that, and that was the same summer? Was that the same summer that they... No, the next summer they signed Tucker Pullman, who obviously concussion issues, similar issues, frankly, similar injury.
To Ferland, yeah.
Yeah, and a similar manifestation where the guy just can't make it through a game, and it's terribly sad. You know, effectively has ended Pullman's playing days too, not officially, but practically speaking.
Likely, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, club's not going to likely look to move that contract. I'm sure they'd be open to it, but they're not going to sweeten the pot to get someone to take it, just like they were reluctant to in acquiring Nate Schmidt. And so, yeah, so we're year six. It'll be year six of the Canucks being fully in LTI. Assuming that they are. I think they will be, ultimately.
You think something will come along in time before the season starts to turn their head, shall we say?
I do. I mean, look around the league right now, Batch, and what team do you feel like is done? You know, like the good teams. I'm talking about the really good teams. Like Edmonton has another move to make, right? We look at their roster, it's like they have another move to make. Vegas, they're lying in wait.
Colorado probably needs to make some moves with their cap situation.
Especially as they sort of wait out the uncertainty on both Nichushkin and Gabriel Landeskog.
Yeah.
You know, like, I guess Nashville looks kind of done, but for the most part, like, all of these teams, Florida's going to make multiple moves before the season starts, or certainly before the start of December. So there's a lot of these contending teams, or a lot of these, you know, high-end teams that are looking up and down their lineup, and I guarantee you are thinking what's next as opposed to what do we have, and that makes this all the more fascinating. It's that dynamic that makes me feel pretty confident that Jim Rutherford and Elvin aren't exactly turning down the heat on the stove and stopping cooking.
You are listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650 on Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day. Yes?
No, I just wanted to
try okay,
on.
You're just...
I like to spike his blood pressure when he's like mad about us going to break late by pretending I have another point to make.
Yes. Yep. Well, it is Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day, so he doesn't get to be mad at you. That's not allowed. And we'll read some more great compliments coming into the Dunbar Lumber text line about Thomas Drantz on his final show of the season when we return. Brendan Batchelor in for Jamie Dodd alongside Thomas Drantz. It is Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Mike Halford
and Jason Brough.
Join us for Halford and Brough in the Morning weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. on Sportsnet 650.
Or on demand anytime through your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Brendan Batchelor in for Jamie Dodd alongside Canucks insider Thomas Drantz. And it is Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day because it's Drantz's final show before we head into the summer. And he gets a well-deserved break after all his hard work during the season. So the rule today is if you want your question...
I do work hard. Thanks, Batch.
You do. I wasn't joking about that. I'm serious. You do work very hard. Harder than me, I think. That's probably fair to say.
I know. I doubt that. You prepare.
Yes. Well, I try anyway. So the rule today is you can send your questions in. We're probably not going to have time to get to all of them because there is way more Thomas Drantz appreciation in the inbox than I even predicted. But if you want your question answered on the show today, you need to say something nice about Drantzer first because it's Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day. Here is Henry.
That's the toll.
Henry in Red Deer / Parksville says, on Thomas Strantz Appreciation Day, I want to say that I used to detest Thomas's takes. He was muted on my Twitter and often turned off Canucks talk. But in the last year and a half, Thomas has become, without a doubt, my favorite Canucks radio host guest personality, bar none. He is the most measured, thoughtful, and funny personality on the airwaves.
Oh, this is actually nice.
And I exclusively listen to him and Jamie because they are such a lovely and entertaining pair. Aww. I love you, Thomas. You have won me over in the last year.
Wow, thank
you. Please forgive my past digressions because you're the best in the business. I have no questions.
Oh, wow. Very kind. Thank you. It means a lot to both me and I guarantee Jamie as well.
And I'm really enjoying you, watching you squirm, having to listen to all these nice things said about you.
Tough. It's tough. But I it means a lot. I promise.
Okay, here is an unsigned text. Thomas Drance reminds me.
Discomfort.
Thomas Drance reminds me of that '90s song guy. Don't worry, be happy. Question: are the players coming in early again to get the season going like last year, or did that ship sail?
I would imagine they are. I don't know that for sure, but you know, I'm sure they'll be out on the ice at 8 rinks early, the way they were last season. Because when something works, you tend not to change it, right? What, like, it would be silly in the extreme to not just replicate everything that gave this team their try hard mojo last season, right? I mean, I thought that was a really useful change for this group, right? And Tockett's talked about it a little bit, the idea that, like, you know, his focus on line changes and some of that, like, simple postural stuff early on in his tenure matters, because if you do that stuff, everything else falls into place. By the end of the season, the Canucks had this, like, try-hard ethos that was so ingrained, like, even at warm-up skate, you know? Every other team has, like, two guys out late, and it's, like, 12 Canucks. You know, it's like, we get it.
There were times where there were guys on, like, 30 to 45 seconds after warm-up had ended, and there were still, like, five of them on the ice, and it was like, you know, you guys have to leave. Like, yeah. The game's got to start at some point.
And it was like that at optionals, and it was like that in everything they did. And so you end up with this sort of, like, hard-driving, hyper-focused, hyper-disciplined ethos. And then when you factor in or combine that with the highly specific way that this team looked to win games, right? And how tied up that was, for example, with the idea of making extremely conservative decisions in terms of puck management in all three zones, right? The idea that when you gain the blue line, you can't turn it over. That's, like, number one cardinal sin, because that might result in the rush chance against. And that's exactly what the Canucks didn't want to surrender given the composition of their defense, and on and on. I think it all mattered in terms of winning and coming in early, that level of seriousness. You know, I think that's a huge part of sort of what we're talking about, what worked for this team. So I would expect, and I would hope, frankly, for the fans of this team, that everything is done sort of to the letter of how it was last year. Because just don't mess with success. That's, like, rule number one in sports, business, entertainment.
Yeah.
Right? Just if it's not broke, don't fix.
Well, and I think maybe the most important factor is that they started the season so well. And that's going to be important again, because we've seen what happens to Canuck teams, even decent Canuck teams, when they're chasing because they have a slow start. So coming in early, being prepared, being able to hit the ground running, especially with another early road trip after a couple of home games to start the year, and playing some good teams, like going to Florida, going to Tampa right away, playing early season Philadelphia Flyers.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, like,
that was exactly the point I was about to make.
Yeah. So they need to be prepared and they need to be ready to go. And I imagine they will be. I would be surprised if we're sitting here going, oh, they were back early at 8 rinks or UBC or wherever it was they were skating last year, and that's not happening this year.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, actually, to have early season tickets to the Michkov show. I'm looking forward to that. Here's the other thing, though. I do think while hashtag the start last season was so important, given that this team hadn't gotten off to one in so long, I do think this team should have the quality where if they're 500 after 10,
you're not worried about it.
I just think there's too much concentration in the Pacific Division, like, especially given that I think Calgary is more likely to compete for a lottery spot than a wild card spot. You know, the way that I sort of assess the Pacific with Seattle and LA, you know, LA could be a tough out. I think people are probably too low on them, even though I hated their work in free agency and generally all offseason.
I'm always wary of teams that people are universally low
out on. I know.
Right?
Well,
like, even Calgary, I would say.
No,
like,
no. don't.
Okay. No. But
that's a bridge too far. But LA, sure. Yeah. LA could still be a surprisingly like hard team to break down and score on.
With Calgary, I'm not saying they're going to be good. I'm just saying they may not be as bad as a lot of people are saying they're going to be.
Mm. I think they're going to be way worse than people expect.
Well, we'll see. We'll circle back on that one.
We'll wait till September to see like what else transpires, but I strongly believe that Calgary will finish behind one of San Jose or Anaheim.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. The bottom end of the Pacific Division is going to be interesting for a whole different reason than the top of the Pacific Division, and that's going to be one of those factors, is how much better is San Jose this year, assuming Celebrini plays in the NHL.
Smith, yeah.
You know, can Anaheim finally take a step after people expecting them to take a step year after year and it not happening? You know,
yeah, I'm going to keep picking Anaheim to take a huge step because I'm going to be right eventually. I think the gap between a team like Anaheim and a team like LA or Seattle, for example, is bigger than people realize. But as you accumulate the critical mass of talent required to sort of shoot through that gap, it happens all at once. It's like, it's not like those teams tend to emerge as like a 92-point team that's in it at the end of the season. Sometimes you see it a little bit toward the back half of the year.
Well, even look at the Canucks and how fast their turnaround
right,
was.
Right, but I'm thinking more like the St. Louis team that Vancouver defeated in the first round in 2009, you know, where it was like Oshie, Backes, Perron, kind of that, Pietrangelo, kind of that group's emergence as like a serious force, and they went like 28-3-2 down the stretch, you know what I mean? Like, it's you wait for it, it's frustrating, and then it happens suddenly and all at once. And I do think Anaheim's that profile of team. It's going to happen one of these years. Maybe it's not this year, but I absolutely think it could be. Especially with Cutter Gauthier. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see for sure. Jesse from Bear Mountain writes in, and he pays the toll on Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day by saying, Drantz can dish it and take it with a shared laugh, the quality of a great bud. And then he asks,
thank you.
What do you predict for Pod Colson? Fourth line, 20 points, top six, or traded? I can't wait to hear Thomas answer without breathing for the next 5 minutes.
That's a good note. So I'm going to pick a couple Canucks players from history and drop some comparisons. Okay. Like, where were they at? Because Pod Colson just finished his age 22 season and it was not good enough. Like, it just was not very good at all, to be totally honest with you, right? The fact of the matter is
from the start, too, like training camp
was off.
Was not good.
No. Nope.
He was, you know.
He looked like he was in his own way, too, right? Like, but he finishes the year with 28 points in 44 AHL games. That's deeply pedestrian production. And then 2 points in 19 NHL games and gets into two games in the playoffs, three with the Abbotsford Canucks. So 5 playoff games in total, 1 assist. No bottom line, no production to his game. It was a deeply concerning setback season for Vasily Podkolzin, and there's sort of no two ways about that. Now, 22-year-old players tend to be difference makers if they're in the NHL, right? Like, if you're going to emerge, even if you're going to emerge as something no one saw when you were 22, you tend to be productive. Even if you're going to bust, you tend to be a lot more productive than 3 assists in, you know, 20 NHL games in your age 22 season. So let's start with like the highest possible end comp of a first round pick, bottom 6 power forward to begin their career, who maybe goes on to bigger and better things. JT Miller. So JT Miller famously struggled to cement himself in the New York Rangers lineup as a young player. Was in first Torts' doghouse and then Alain Vigneault's doghouse, with Alain Vigneault taking pains to criticize him specifically as he, you know, couldn't get into the lineup. And of course, Vigneault was widely criticized for that. In JT Miller's age 19 and 20 season, you know, he wasn't as productive as Podkolzin was in his 20 and 21-year-old seasons. Like, remember, Podkolzin is a 20-year-old, stuck with the Canucks all season, got better as the year went on, and had 26 points and 14 goals in 79 games. At 19, JT Miller, or sorry, at the same age, which would be, yeah, 19, JT Miller played 26 games in the NHL and had 4 points, and the next season played 30 games and had 6, which is a little more like Podkolzin's 39 games and 7 points. Like, literally, you could draw a pretty straight line between Podkolzin's age 2021 seasons and JT Miller's age 2021 seasons and say even that Podkolzin had shown more upside than JT Miller had at that stage of his career. Where these paths really begin to diverge is in the age 22 season. We've already gone over what Podkolzin did. It was at the age of 22 that Miller went off 22 goals, 43 points. Right?
And that was his first full year in the NHL.
Finally stuck in the league.
Did not go down to the AHL at all.
Yeah, and then has never been back since and has been like a pretty consistent, you know, 50 to like 45 to 55 point guy. And then after the trade to Vancouver became sort of a top 10 in the league points guy thereafter. And then this season leveled up again, even if, you know, you can make the production case and be like, Miller's been this guy ever since he arrived in Vancouver. That's not true, right? Like, first of all, he played a full season on the wing. Then he struggled the next season. Then he played at center and had 99 points, but his defensive game was poor. Then the next season he played full season at center.
Missed one game and had 82 points games. So
wasn't good as a two-way player on a team that got flattened in terms of their ability to control games 5-on-5, just surrendered way too many rush chances, way too many goals, and, you know, was part of the problem in terms of the team's defense until the last 30 games of the year. And then this year was just an absolute...
Put it all together.
Was just an absolute killer, yeah. Right? Like, to the point where, you know, is, like, doing an incredible lockdown job on Connor McDavid in the Stanley Cup playoffs, probably the best job we saw anyone but Alexander Barkov, literally the best defensive center in the league, do on Connor McDavid in this postseason. So, you know, there's like a subtle change even in Miller's profile over the last 12 months that I think we'd be remiss not to acknowledge, in part because I think he deserves credit for it. It's an amazing feat to become a different type of player again at the age of 30. Anyway, that's the sort of the highest upside case. Now, here's another one. Rafi Torres in his age 20 and 21 seasons. So this would be the mid case where it's like Rafi Torres had a totally good career.
Yeah, I think at this point, if you told Canucks fans that Podkolzin would end up as a Rafi Torres type, maybe not in terms of the physicality and the big hits and the suspensions or anything like that. Yeah, but in terms of the level of player that he is in the league, the kind of production you can get, the kind of consistency you can get, I think Canuck fans would probably take that from Podkolzin right now.
They should. Rafi Torres was the type of bottom six forward who you win with, namely a bottom six forward who, yeah, he's not going to play on the power play, he's not going to put up 50 points, but he's going to score at a top six rate and not make a lot of money while doing a ton of little things that help you win. Like, that's the story of the failed first liner becoming a super effective checking player or checker is, you know, a well-trod path in the NHL, and those are useful players. Those are players you win with. So if that's the path that Podkolzin takes, that's great. Now, Podkolzin, again, with Rafi Torres, was ahead of him at the ages of 20 and 21. Rafi Torres played 31 games in his age 20 and 21 seasons in the NHL and didn't score. He had six
assists in two seasons.
Yep. And played
31 games.
Yeah. Yep. It was the next season, though, that age 22 season, he kind of popped off 20 goals, 34 points.
Like, played 80 games.
Yeah. That's kind of where he got to. And then here's the last one I want to bring up. You know, someone who really did not make it, and that's Jake Virtanen. Okay. Now, Virtanen played most of his for age 19 season in the NHL, seven goals, six assists. Played 10 games in the NHL the next season, one assist. His age 21 season and age 22 seasons, he was in the league the whole time, but it was like 10 goals, 10 assists. Kind of, you know, just kind of like there. And it was at 23 that he had that big year that convinced Canucks fans that he was actually good.
36 points in 69 games that year.
Yeah. And then, of course, five goals in 38 games in his final NHL season. When you sort of go over those, it's like, at this point with a player, to do as little as Podkolzin did in his age 22 season puts him behind busts, mid-range guys, and guys who became stars. Like, it's very hard to find the profile of a player who is a complete zero at the age of 22, the way Podkolzin was, and then goes on to anything. Like, you know, I think we pulled out the full range of powerful forwards you could be in the NHL.
And I think we do also have to underscore how rare the JT Miller scenario is in this
case.
Oh,
absolutely.
Like, it does not happen.
No, not very often.
Yeah.
Especially given, you know, coming into the league as a power wing and all the transitions. I mean, that's a credit to what Miller has done. Now, with Podkolzin, I would say his season was troubling enough that I don't know that we should have any reasonable expectations for, like, I don't think there are should be reasonable I don't think any expectation of him contributing anything whatsoever next season
at the NHL level
is reasonable, period.
Yeah.
And yet his age 20 season was so impressive that I don't want to throw that out either. Right. I sort of almost want to, like, put it all together. You know what I mean? And sort of look at Podkolzin instead of a guy who had this tremendous rookie season and then has had these fall off sort of campaigns. I'd prefer to look at him as a guy who's played, you know, a season and a half of hockey, right? He's played 136 games. So it's like, or 137 games. So it's like he's played a season and a half of hockey and, you know, has contributed at like a 25 goal or 25 point, 26 point pace across that season and a half per 82. Right. So it's like, I think that's the better way to kind of look at what he's accomplished. And if we sort of look at it that way, his profile looks much more like the Torres profile or the Virtanen profile than certainly than the JT Miller profile, because that was a 40 point season at the age of 22. But, you know, that's at least he sort of fits within that wheelhouse. And I look at a player and I see the size and I see the work rate and I see the work ethic and I hear stories about the work ethic behind the scenes. And all of that makes me look at him as a guy that I want to bet on, right? Like the unique physical profile, just how hard he competes, the motor, all of that makes me want to bet on him. And yet at some point there has to be a bottom line, right? It's not
the rubber has to meet the road.
And so I think we extend him a little bit of patience. I think at this point, anything he gives you is found money, but I'm not closing the door on his ability to do so, especially with how hard he works. I just don't think you can count on him or even pencil him. Like, I wouldn't even pencil him into the fourth line. It's kind of like he's coming to camp with a shot, but I will be equally unsurprised if he comes into camp and makes like a really strong case to play as high as the top nine. I will be equally as unsurprised by that as I would be if he ended up on waivers.
Well, and from a player development perspective, might it not be prudent to send him back to the AHL even if he does have a good camp and comes in and shows well?
Well, he requires waivers now.
Oh, that's true.
So
yes. So this may be...
This is kind of it. And
yeah, you're right.
And he's kind of a player for whom...
Is there a chance he would clear, do you think?
No.
Yeah.
No, I think his recent draft capital and profile is too appealing to certain teams. And by the way, this is he might be the guy, if he's not ready this year, he might be the guy that waivers are kind of for, right? Like, is there a chance that you'll never find out if Podkolzin can play, if he's on a good team, playing fourth line minutes, maybe in and out of the press box,
he might need to go to San Jose.
He might
or
need to go
like
play
that.
A bigger role and kind of work his way through whatever's been holding him back, because it's pretty clearly between his ears. He can shoot, he can pass, he's a big body. You know, he's not a like high end skater, but he can get there. Like I see no reason for him to have not succeeded to a greater degree than he has, and yet he hasn't. So, you know, effectively this is kind of like, it feels pretty do or die for his overall Canucks tenure. And so I think we go into the season and try and give him a blank slate and try and think, like, let's just scrub last season and look at the entire body of work and say there's maybe some promise here, but he's certainly a distressed asset who, if he doesn't show us something pretty significant last season, there might not be anything there or next season.
Well, and with the waiver situation, like he has to beat out those other guys and
yeah.
make the roster. And if he doesn't, it's most likely that he's not a Vancouver Canuck come October, November.
The listener texted it and was like, 5 minutes without breathing. And it's like, we did a whole segment of Podkolzin, baby. We'll do a lightning round, I guess. We'll have to do a lightning round in the last one.
We will, for sure. We are going to be joined by Kevin Woodley coming up in a few minutes here on Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day, the final Canucks talk of the season before the summer. Plenty of Thomas Drantz appreciation texts coming in. Keith writes in, says, Thomas is must listen when a trade happens. Nobody breaks down a trade better. and wants to know. So let's do a quick lightning round here. How confident are you that Petey will have a bounce back season, and what does a bounce back season look like?
For Petey?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. Like, it looks like Pettersson dominating 5-on-5 on a constant basis. It looks like him driving play. Here's what it looks like. It looks like the Canucks outscoring their opponents by 20 in his minutes. It looks like him putting up 90 to 105 points with 35 plus goals and, you know, helping to stir the drink again on the power play. Like, I think he's got to start scoring some of those one-timers again, or at the very least, he's got to start finding those backdoor feeds on the power play. It didn't feel like there was enough being created by him 5-on-4 last season in addition to some of the other issues. That's what it looks like. Like, it looks like a guy who is, on a relatively consistent basis, the reason the Canucks win. Like, at least once or twice a week.
And
because that's what it looks like when he's on his game.
Well, and his other question was, how confident are you that he will have that bounce back season? So I think we would probably both agree that we're more confident than not that he will bounce back. But I don't know if you want to put a percentage on it or whether you think it's likely or not.
I mean, look, he still had 90 points, didn't he? Like, he was still.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident. I'm pretty confident because it's, again, extremely rare for a player to be as good as Pettersson has been.
89 points to
yeah.
be.
I mean, it's extremely rare to be as good as Pettersson has been as consistently as Pettersson has been that good throughout his career and then kind of amount to nothing. Like, that, it doesn't make sense. Like, to hit 100 points in your fourth season, you know, and then to hit 90 in your fifth season, and now we're talking about him like he's a liability on this team? Like, that's just not kind of how it works for elite players. I've never seen a flash in the
outside
pan
of injuries.
Outside of severe injuries.
And, yeah.
And even in that case, like, you know, Stamkos, fourth season, 97 points. Next season, 57 in 48 games, the truncated season. Then it's the Sochi Olympic year where he breaks his leg, the tibia, on the in the game in Boston. He had 40 points in 37 games at the time of that injury. Comes back the next year, and it's like 72 points and 64 points in complete seasons. Has another injury-plagued year in which he has 20 and 17. That was the blood clot season. And then 86-98, you know what I mean? Then he's Steven Stamkos again. Just
yeah.
Like, so, I mean, I don't know. There's no injury that severe that would lead me to expect that there's like a multi-year dip coming in Pettersson's future. And he's already sort of left behind like the Stasny, like, is only a good player, not a great player case behind by doing what he's done the last 2 years in terms of production. 190 points in two seasons. That's wild, wild stuff. So, yeah, I'd say I'm 80% confident that Pettersson comes back and at least gives the Canucks, like, not just first-line impact, but star-level first-line impact next season.
This is Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Brendan Batchelor in for Jamie Dodd alongside Thomas Drantz on Thomas Drantz Appreciation Day. Back with more in a moment on Sportsnet 650.